Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. First, in a minute or so, we'll hear from David K. Johnston on Mitt Romney's semi-vast wealth and very light tax burden. And then at the bottom of the hour, the writer and editor Joel Shalit will talk to us about anti-democratic tendencies in an increasingly militarized Israel. No time for news commentary today. A technical note, these interviews were done via Skype. The overall sound quality is better than a regular phone line, but it is subject to annoying dropouts. I'm not sure which is better. First up, David K. Johnston, a columnist for Reuters. His specialty is taxes, with an emphasis on how rich people get away with paying next to nothing. David K. Johnston. Welcome, David. So I guess Mitt Romney is probably keeping you rather busy these days, huh?
He's the gift that keeps on giving if you're in my business.
Okay, yes. So there's several issues in his personal tax returns. What's your personal theory on why he doesn't want to release any more than he has so far?
Well, I think there is a very good chance that there were years when he paid little or no income tax. He's been very careful about how he's worded these things. He said, for example, that he's paid at least 13% each year for the last 10 years. Well, the period he's most likely to have paid little or no tax would have been in the 90s. And I've been calling since last year for him to release all his returns since 1984, the first year that he had significant income. And I think that we do need to understand, even if everything he's done is legal, the scandal is often not the venality of an individual, and there's no evidence of venality on his part, but the system itself. And I think that Mitt Romney has turned out unexpectedly to be the poster boy for real tax reform and is putting, along with Paul Ryan, a human face on the kinds of issues that I've been writing about for years, on how the super rich game the system to delay, defer, avoid, and sometimes completely escape taxes.
Well, let's review some of the ways in which someone like Mitt Romney can pay a lower tax rate than you or me or the janitors that cleaned his office building.
Well, the most important one is that as the sole owner and manager of Bain Capital Management, he was allowed to do something called carried interest. And what that means is you or I go to work, anybody else goes to work, we are taxed at the higher rates that apply to labor than the lower rates that apply to capital. Even though Romney is being paid for his work, it is compensation for services, he gets to, as a hedge fund manager, take a share of the profits taxed at the lower rate. On top of that, as a private equity rather than a hedge fund manager, he then gets to defer, if he chooses, all of his income. You or I, as workers, can only save about $17,000 if you're under 50 and $23,000 if you're over 50. However, Mr. Romney is allowed to save unlimited sums, as are every other person who manages a private equity fund, a hedge fund, or a similar device. So there's two elements of this. Then, of course, there is the lower rate on dividends and interest by themselves that Ronald Reagan wanted everything taxed at the same rate. Once that got in place, the Republicans began pushing for lower rates on capital incomes, and we now have the 15% rate, whereas the top rate for labor income is 35%.
You said earlier that Romney is the sole owner of Bain. Is this typical for a PE or a hedge fund guy?
I don't think there's anything particularly unusual about the way he was running his private equity fund, no. I mean, basically, the private equity guys, they're not in the business of long-term entrepreneurship. They're not the DuPont family, which still owns a business they began in the 1700s. They're not the Ford Motor Company, which the Ford family has been deeply involved in since the late 1800s. They are instead people who get in and out. It may be 7, 10, 12 years getting in and out, but in terms of business, that's an incredibly short period of time.
Well, of course, Bain, or rather Romney and some of Bain's apologists claim that they're not like those other guys. They're real patient builders. They're not asset strippers. What do you make of that?
Well, they built at least one big company, Staples. But let me give you another example of the kind of deal they did, which has been a huge scandal in Italy, but hardly mentioned here. The Italian government bought into the whole Milton Friedman notion that we should break up the utility companies, just like half the states did here in the U.S. for electricity, and as we did with Ma Bell and the telephone business. And so the Italian telephone system had to sell its directory services. Well, they bought those for a song, resold them at a gain of about $25 or $28 to one. But because they did it all through a Luxembourg entity, they paid virtually no Italian taxes. Romney personally benefited to the tune, it's been reported in Italy, of about $60 million, which, if true, would mean that a quarter of what he says is his fortune comes from this single deal in Italy. And they were in and out in a couple of years in that deal. By the way, the company has since collapsed in value and is worth close to nothing.
That seems to be a story, common story. Now, you were talking earlier about the ways in which Romney's income is sheltered or partly sheltered from taxes. But there's also what you alluded to, the Luxembourg and the Cayman Islands, all these dodges. How does that fit into the picture? I imagine his taxable income is already lower than what we might think of as his de facto income is anyway.
Well, a couple of things affect Romney's income. The $21.6 million that he reported for 2010, the only year for which he's released a tax return, includes money that under any normal circumstance involving ordinary Americans would actually go to his sons. Let me take a moment to explain, because I think this is a very important item about the Romneys. Ann and Mitt Romney have five grown sons who are the beneficiaries of a $100 million trust. Some months ago, the campaign acknowledged, in response to a question that I asked through another Reuters reporter, that no gift taxes were paid. Now, they couldn't have put, at the time the trust was created, more than about $2 million into this trust. In fact, I believe they put in less than $1.2 million. So how did it grow to $100 million? Well, the tax law allows you to own something that you know next year or even next month is going to be incredibly valuable, but right now has no value. And think about that in terms of, you create a little company called Doug Henwood Inc., and you put $1,000 into it. But you know that General Electric is going to sign a contract with you 6 months from now, and the first payment they're going to make to you is $100 million. You can now give that to your children and value it at $1,000. That's what the Romneys apparently did. They gave their children something that, for tax purposes, had little or no value. And it turns out that if you are the recipient of this thing called carried interest, the share of profits that you get from your investors for making money for them, you can value it at zero or close to zero. And I think that's what they probably did. Now, the really sweet part of this deal is that Mitt and Ann Romney pay the income taxes on behalf of their five sons. So their five sons get the annual income from a $100 million trust, $20 million each, and pay no taxes on the money because mom and dad paid it for them.
That's very sweet of mom and dad.
But yes, it also reduces the state because they're not giving their children, notice they paid no gift tax, but now they're getting this huge tax expense that reduces the size of their estate and therefore increases the share of it that will end up going to their children, assuming they don't make charitable gifts when they die.
Not just a matter of clarification. With a gift tax, it's usually the giver, not the recipient, who pays, right?
That's right. Unless the giver fails to pay the tax, the giver pays the tax. If the giver didn't pay it and, let's say, absconds or runs off, then you, the recipient, can be hit to pay the tax. That's extraordinarily rare. But normally you pay the tax. And the reason for this is to back up the income tax. George W. Bush in 2001 had a plan to eliminate the gift tax. And I think it was 10 days after he took office, I had a front page story in the New York Times pointing out that this would allow very wealthy people to completely escape taxes on their gains. For example, Bill Gates could give his fortune to an elderly aunt as long as she lived a year and a day and then left it to him in her will. He could end up getting all the money through a trust while never paying taxes on it. So the gift tax is very important. And the gift tax, by the way, was put into the law in 1924 at the behest of Republicans.
I'm speaking with David K. Johnston, who is a columnist for Reuters. Okay, now let's get back to the shelter business. Gawker the other day published a cache of documents detailing a whole bunch of Romney vehicles, Bain vehicles, that were domiciled in offshore. Just give us a rundown on how that sort of thing works.
Well, there's two reasons that you go offshore, and then there's what was revealed in these documents. If you are a foreign investor, you don't want to fill out a U.S. tax return. So you don't invest in Bain. You invest in a Cayman Islands company, and it invests in Bain. And this blocks you from having to file a U.S. tax return. Americans do the same thing. If you buy shares of Mercedes-Benz or Volkswagen or Luxottica, the Italian eye company, you buy what are called American depository receipts. And technically, you don't own the company. You own a company that owns shares in that company. And therefore, you don't have to fill out a German or Italian tax return. If you're an American nonprofit, say the Harvard Endowment, and you invest in a way that uses borrowed money, your gains become taxable. So instead, you invest in the Cayman Islands company, and you're exempted from taxes on the gains by doing that. That's the bread and butter normal part of this, and nobody should criticize Romney for that. Like it or not, that's the way business is done. What these audit documents that Gawker got reveal is the use of swaps and trades to escape the 15% tax on dividends. And if you are the recipient of, say, a dividend from General Electric, and you've got $1 million coming, and you're offshore, the U.S. government says, no, you have to withhold 15% to pay the tax. So the offshore entity then says, goes to a bank and says, we're going to make you a deal. You take the dividend, and we'll take from you the value of the stock a year from today plus the value of the dividend, and then we'll swap after a year. That way you avoid paying the 15% dividend tax. There's clear indications that they were engaged in this practice, and I suspect if we had a full picture, we would see that even if he's in complete perfect compliance with the law, the public would be pretty shocked at Romney's efforts to Romney's efforts to avoid taxes through these hyper specific exploitations of holes in the tax code.
Now, what you just described, that swap, though, it sounds like it has no economic purpose. It's purely tax avoidance. What does the IRS think of that?
You're correct. Its sole purpose is tax avoidance. And there's something called the economic substance doctrine. If something is done solely to avoid taxes, it's not supposed to be legal. Because after all, if it was solely to do that, people could just move numbers around on pieces of paper and make their taxes disappear. You have to actually be invested in the business and take risk. The IRS, however, has been cut and cut and cut. The government has been pressuring the most experienced auditors to leave. The government has a rule now that when a company is audited, they tell the company in advance what they're going to audit, and the company knows exactly what's going to be audited. And if the auditors get in and say, hey, wait a minute, we picked the wrong subjects, this is clean what we're looking at, but over here is something absolutely scandalous, the IRS says, no, we can't look at that. We told the company we wouldn't look at that. This is just like the sheriff who used to call up the madam and say, hey, listen, we got to conduct a raid tonight to make the newspapers happy. So get all of the girls and your better customers out of the joint before we arrive.
Well, the Department of Labor did that with Walmart, too. So I guess it's a common practice. But you said just a moment ago that the IRS has driven out its best auditors. Did I catch that correctly?
Yes. They've been pushing on auditors at the top, making their lives miserable. I've talked to lots of them, how unhappy they are. I want to go back for just a second if I can. 40 years ago, I wrote when I was at the Detroit Free Press about how in the state of Michigan, pet shop investigations were done with no notice. The inspectors just would show up to see if your pet shop was properly run. But nursing home investigations, they got a week's notice to clean up the joint. So we care more, apparently, about the welfare of rodents and cats at the pet store than we do grandma.
Yes. That's remarkable, too. We seem to be in the territory of Leona Helmsley. Taxes are just for the little people.
Well, yes, and here's what's important. Very wealthy people in number pay big amounts of tax. But the reason is that their incomes are enormous. And the only people whose incomes have been exploding in America are the top 1% of the top 1%. That's the group Romney's in. That's people whose incomes begin at about $9 million a year. Romney appears to be in the $20 million a year class. And those people's incomes have gone up and up and up. The bottom 90% of Americans had higher incomes when you adjust for inflation back in 1973 than they do now. And this is the result, I believe, of Reaganism. The policies that Ronald Reagan pursued, which he said were going to unleash all of these wealth creators, and they have. And they've allowed these people to realize enormously higher incomes because they're paying lower tax rates.
And returning to Romney, the person, someone said he's the 1% of the 1%, but he is utterly run of the mill for that crowd, right? I mean, there are many Romneys running around.
Romney is a pipsqueak among that crowd. I mean, if you believe what he says, that his fortune is only $250 million, and I don't, I think that's a value. You know, there are lots of ways to value wealth. You know, what you think about your house. Is your house worth what you could say to somebody, well, it's a $100,000 house because that's what you paid for it 40 years ago, or it's $1 million house because that's what you could sell it for tomorrow. And I think Romney has lowballed the size of his wealth. But among that crowd, he's a complete nobody. We have people in America now who make billion-dollar annual incomes, not billion-dollar fortunes, billion-dollar annual incomes.
And they're playing all the same games that Romney did.
I assume all of them are, because they're not showing up in the official statistics. And Doug, here's one of the really great scandals that we need to address, and that Romney's case, I hope, gets people to focus on. Most people, even if they have some savings, they have to go to work every day in order to feed themselves and take care of themselves and their family if they have one. If you had $1 billion and you're earning 5%, that's $50 million a year, and you pay taxes on it, you're going to be left, if you pay at the top rate, still going to be left with 70% of that money, okay? Because you're going to have some deductions and charitable gifts and whatnot. But you're going to have plenty of money. But instead, if you invest in companies, including it could be your own, that don't pay any dividends, you just let the value of the stock rise. You go to your banker and you say, you know, I need $10 million this year. Your banker loans you $10 million at today about 2% interest. At the end of the year, you owe your banker $10,200,000. And you say to your banker, you know, I need another $10 million. Well, they just roll it over into another loan. Your fortune has grown by $50 million. Your bank debt has only gone up by $20 million. You're way ahead. And so long as you have a fortune growing faster than your spending, you can live on borrowed money all your life, get richer and richer, and never pay taxes.
And then does it become a problem for your heirs? How do you eventually settle things up?
Well, when you die, you have all these loans that have to be paid off. That reduces the size of your estate. But you, at the same time, could take the tax savings that you have, and the lowest rate you could pay would be 15%, and go buy life insurance, put it in a trust, and when your time runs out, your children will get the proceeds of that life insurance tax-free.
Now, finally, on the policy matter, Romney has been about as forthcoming on the details of his tax policies as he has been with his tax returns, but what can you gather that he would do should he get the keys to the Oval Office?
Now, it is amazing. He has a 160-page plan, and you don't know what he wants to do. He has said a couple of things. He wants to increase spending on the military. The U.S. government now spends close to half the worldwide military spending, but he wants more. Apparently didn't hear the farewell address of President Eisenhower, who warned about the influence of the military-industrial complex. He wants to eliminate, he says, every possible program he can, unless it's absolutely vital and necessary. Well, he hasn't said what vital and necessary is, but you can predict that it will hit people who are poor, middle class, disabled, sick, and elderly first and foremost. His companion on the ticket, Paul Ryan, has a radical plan. that would raise taxes on the middle class by about 50%. If you're making $100,000 a year, just take a look at your federal taxes, payroll tax and income tax, and it'll go up by about half. It would radically cut taxes on people at the very top. Both Romney and Ryan want to eliminate the estate tax. Ryan wants to get rid of the taxes on dividends and capital gains. And basically what they want to do is already rich people can live at very, very low tax rates. Under the Ryan plan, Romney would pay an effective tax rate of under 1%. But working people would pay much higher taxes in order to fund a much smaller government. This is just simply a plan to take from those with less, to give to those with more. And one of the things, Doug, I've been saying about, you got to say for the Republicans, is unlike the Democrats, at least the Republicans have identified what they believe is America's major economic problem and proposed a solution. The problem Republicans see is that the rich do not have nearly enough for the economy to grow and prosper, and that the way to get more money to the rich is to take from the old, the sick, the disabled, children, and the mentally ill, and give to the rich.
But yet the polls are a virtual tie at this point, so what's the public thinking?
Well, remember, we live in a country where there are people who will tell you Sarah Palin was fit to be commander-in-chief. Lots of people pay no attention to anything, but do we like this guy? Look at all the polls from the 2000 election where people were asked and indicated that they voted for George W. Bush. Why? Because, well, he'd be a nice guy to have a beer with. Never mind that he's a totally unsophisticated man with, brilliantly portrayed in the movie W. No matter mind that he couldn't tell you a Shiite from a Sunni, and more importantly, that he apparently did not understand that so long as Saddam Hussein was in power, he was a force working against Iran, a country whose current leaders clearly deeply dislike the United States, and never heard of the line, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Americans are astonishingly ill-informed about the issues that confront them, and they are encouraged in this by Rupert Murdoch's Fox News, which is just so blatantly dishonest that anybody who makes any effort can quickly establish that there is no regard for truth. This isn't a function of, do you have a viewpoint about the world? It's they have no regard for truth at Fox.
I'm David K. Johnston, a columnist for Reuters. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of Music You Can Dance To by Sparks, no definite article like Messiah and Goethe Dämmerung. My next guest is Joel Shalit, co-editor of the webzine Sissient and author most recently of Israel vs. Utopia from Akashic Books, Joel Shalit. Welcome, Joel. One of the recent interviews we had, you said towards the end of it that maybe it is wrong to talk about Israel becoming a fascist state because it's always been in some sense. And of course, that's a provocative remark, and it sounds like where an interview should begin instead of end. So here we are. Let's begin with that one. What exactly did you mean?
It all depends on what your ethnicity is. Certainly, if you're an Israeli citizen of Arab descent or of Arab background, or if you're a subject of the Israeli colonial administration in the West Bank, there's little to boast about the values of Israeli democracy, at least in the same way that an Israeli Jew who either lives on a settlement or lives in Israel proper might boast about it.
What would the analogy be to, say, a poor black person or an immigrant in the U.S.? Is it a similar situation or remarkably different?
I was just asked this. I was in a discussion with an immigrant rights analyst who has a really cool new book coming out through, I believe it's being distributed in the U.S. by University of Chicago in the fall. And we were talking about the differences between how immigrants and minorities, but largely immigrants, are treated in Europe versus the United States. And I think if you drop the Texas-California border with Mexico out of the equation, there in Europe you tend to feel that immigrants are treated in more as a military problem than they are necessarily in the United States. Though obviously there are, according to a lot of immigrant rights activists, that's been changing for a long time. But yeah. I think that in Israel, minorities tend to have a relationship with the state. Non-Jewish minorities tend to have a relationship to the state that, even if they are citizens of non-Jewish citizens of Israel, is one that is more more militarized and has a security component to it that would surprise Americans who are not white. The experience is not comparable.
Of course, there are restrictions on property ownership, right, for non-Jews.
Well, it depends. Again, it depends on where you live. If you live in Jerusalem, there are all kinds of strange regulations that limit Arab property ownership, depending on what part of town you're in. In Israel proper, Israeli Arabs are not prohibited, for example, from buying property in Jewish areas. But there is immense cultural pressure and social pressure exerted to prevent that from happening. And so consensus limits Arab residency in Tel Aviv rather than law.
Now let's step back some and talk about the intellectual origins of Zionism. It arose in the 19th century with a whole lot of other romantic nationalisms, right?
Yes. Yeah, it did. It did. Zionism is often considered to be a European nationalism or a product of the classical era of European nationalism, which also, of course, gave birth to the varieties of fascism which were prominent in Europe in the early to mid-20th century.
So what's the link? What's the genealogy?
Well, it depends on what your political position is. I mean, if you're a liberal Zionist, nationalism, Jewish nationalism, was an important event and a necessary and inevitable event to save the Jewish community from complete obliteration during the Holocaust. If Jews had not adopted what is considered to be, by liberal left standards today, a negative community identity like Zionism, it's highly probable that a great deal more would have been killed by the Nazis and the Russians. And so whether we like Zionism or judge Zionism to be a retrograde or fascist or anti-democratic or anti-multicultural, it was still necessary.
Then the ideology gets a country and an army.
The problem is what you do after, exactly, what you do after you get that country that nationalism was a necessary interim phase to create. Do you continue to fulfill what many consider to be the negative logic of nationalism and create a non-democratic ethnocracy, or do you create a secular multicultural state? The question is, what do we do with Zionist nationalism or with Jewish nationalism in a context in which we're obligated to develop a secular multicultural democracy in order to properly respect the rights and the presence of a large non-Jewish community in Israel?
Now, how was this debated at the beginning of the state? Were these issues explicitly brought out, or did people just sort of roll on with a very nationalistic model?
In Israel's formal founding, in its Declaration of Independence, equality is guaranteed to everybody regardless of religion or ethnicity.
And was that those just words or that meant?
No, it was meant. It was intended. But immediately, you know, for the next 19 years, Arabs lived under military law and were not regarded as full citizens.
So how is that contradiction resolved?
Well, military law was lifted in 1966, and Arabs, Israeli Arabs, were allowed to interact with the Israeli state as more formal Israeli citizens than they had been allowed to prior to that day. And, you know, an Israeli identity grew from that point onwards. And though Israeli Arabs never felt as though they were treated as full and equal citizens, their sense of presence in the state and their sense of ownership of the state grew substantially. So were expectations for social and cultural equality. And that all came to a crashing halt during the beginning of the Al-Aqsa Intifada, when the demonstrations when demonstrations took place within Israel, especially in the north, and they were violently put down by the police and paramilitary forces.
Why was that such a watershed? What was so dramatically different?
Well, they started the violence against Israeli Arab protesters. Was military in its nature and suggested that the state was adopting a position towards Israel's Arab population that it historically exercised since the beginning of the occupation only against Palestinians in the territories. The actions of the police forces communicated the idea that Israeli Arabs were deemed by the security establishment to be no different than Palestinians living under Israeli military occupation on the other side of the Green Line.
So this is like the occupation comes home.
That's exactly it. And my parents, my family lives in the north, and we really felt it. We really felt this change quite dramatically because northern Israel is characterized by a great deal of cultural crossover between Jews and Arabs, especially given the size of the Arab population in the north. That's where most of Israel's Arab population lives.
What percentage of Israel within the old borders, what percentage is Arab now?
19%, according to Israeli government figures.
And, of course, the paranoia is that they're reproducing like crazy and will become a very significant demographic threat over time, right?
Yeah, especially if Israel holds on to the occupied territories and maintains its colonial regime there.
Okay, so the response, the military response, the repression intensifies, then the nature of it changes. So what ideological accompaniment came with that?
The state's response to Israeli Arab demonstrations in Israel in the fall of 2000 heralded the country's movement rightwards politically. Ariel Sharon and Likud, Ariel Sharon became Israel's leader not long thereafter. He defeated Ehud Barak, the country has been largely run by Likud, though there was a Kadima government in the interim, the last decade, really. I mean, Kadima's just really, I mean, Kadima's kind of a joke, even though it has former labor parliamentarians in its rank. But the violence really foreshadowed the transformation of Israeli politics away from what was regarded to be a peace process oriented politics to a new nationalist politics, one which would emphasize no territorial compromises or negotiations, further negotiations with the Palestinians, and a more Jewish politics in regards to Israeli domestic politics. The state would be more Jewish, that Israeli society ought to be more Jewish. And to this process's credit, it was largely a natural reflection of where Israel has been going politically for the last 30 years. I mean, Israel is becoming more religious. Israel is becoming less democratic. Israel is becoming more provincial and more Middle Eastern at the same time that it may identify, for example, as more European in its relationship to the Arabs.
Yeah, I was thinking, as you're saying that there's this sense that Israel identifies in some sense as a European outpost outpost in surrounded by, you know, barbaric Middle Easterners. But then you're saying there's also this more Middle Eastern feeling. How do these harmonize?
One could say that the identification with Europe and the identification with the West is a false one, insofar as it excludes any kind of faith in liberal democracy or secularism.
This increasing religious Jewish identification for Israel, does this really reflect the population, or is the population more divided than that?
Oh, I think I think Israel's getting more religious. I mean, I think the Haredi community is growing by leaps and bounds. And I just saw some study the other day saying that something to the effect that Israeli school children would be, and this sort of nails it in terms of, if you want to explain why the Jewish community is so anxious, both on the left and on the right, Israel's school children would be evenly divided between ultra-Orthodox Jews and Arabs.
Oh my God.
You know, what a nightmare for certain kinds of people. You know, I mean, how the hell are we going to negotiate that? You know, we have such bad politics regarding tolerance and pluralism in the country. You know, what could be the consequence of a culture clash like that? How could it be managed? Given how utterly, you know, unthoughtful Israel's political establishment is at this point in time about such questions. I mean, you know, it's epitomized by somebody like Avigdor Lieberman, the current foreign minister. It's like, how do you, you know, do you find a way to negotiate a society that's dominated by Israeli Arabs on the one hand and Breslov Hasids on the other? No, you throw the Arabs out. That's how you deal with the problem. I mean, that's the kind of thinking that predominates.
Well, I run across quite a few Israeli expatriates in New York who are in despair over the state of the country, and they complain constantly about the role of the black hats. I mean, is this are a lot of people just leaving?
Well, you know, I mean, who are the people who complain about the black hats? There are a number of different parties in Israel that complain about the Haredim and about the lack of participation in the workforce and the lack of participation in the military. You have to be very of the kinds of criticisms you hear of the Haredim being made in Israel, because they don't necessarily come from progressive political places. They come from business circles, which wants to see economic productivity enhanced and is worried that the country is going to become simply a large collection of welfare recipients called ultra-Orthodox Jews. And these concerns are also echoed by the military, that is rapidly losing an educated, sophisticated, academically trained armed forces. You don't hear, certainly, I the softer voices tend to be ones that, you know, on this question, look at the rising religiosity of the country, of the country's Jewish population, and go, well, obviously that's an indication of the fact that the state is disappearing and that there's no proper social services being given to Israelis, and the only place they can appeal to for any kind of sense of stability or hope is are their rabbis. You do hear criticisms of a growth of religiosity in Israel of that nature, but they're not the ones that most people hear.
I'm speaking with Joel Shalit, co-editor of the webzine Susiant, and whose most recent book is Israel versus Utopia from Akashic Books.
It was inevitable that Israeli Jewish identity would end up becoming more conservative religiously in comparison to its American and diasporic counterparts, especially if you consider the kinds of forces which have molded Israeli Judaism over the years, in contrast to the Judaism of Americans, for example. Israeli Judaism is molded by the military. It's molded by the colonial enterprise in the occupied territories. It's impacted by the increasing class discrepancies which characterize Israeli life. All of the kinds of factors which push for a more extremist kind of religious identity than you would find in liberal social democracies, not subject to the kinds of political and ideological pressures that Israeli Judaism is subject to, factor in the hegemony of the ultra-Orthodox in Israeli life, and the fact that Israeli Judaism is seen as being the sole province of political conservatism, And, you know, you have the kind of Judaism that is emerging today in the country as being one that is fundamentalist and politically inflexible in regards to the demands of Jews to have a religion that means something to them and is capable of being reshaped by them, you know, in the manner that American Jews and European Jews tend to continually reconstruct Judaism. Israel's becoming the sort of the most typically conservative of homes, the kind that, you know, we inevitably look to as being the place that everything began, in which everything is distilled in its purest form, in contrast to the diaspora, where people are free to experiment and create more liberal and experimental versions of their original home country's culture.
A lot of the American Jewish population does seem to be edging away emotionally and politically from the old ties to Israel.
There is a lot of constructive engagement of Israel that's happening right now in the American Jewish religious community, particularly around issues, for example, like the exclusion of women from being able to pray together with men at the Wailing Wall. There's a lot of feminist anxiety, justifiable feminist anxiety in the United States about that, and I could go on. You have older organizations like the New Israel Fund that have been working on social justice issues in Israel forever. My perennial concern with American left wing American Jewish engagement with Israel, especially having worked as the editor at Tikkun for a while, is that it always feels like it's too late. There's no such thing as too late, but obviously, but one worries that there is this perennial trailing of the right's leadership and of right-wing trends leadership in Israel that the left never seems to master.
This is a country that's been in a state of near-perpetual war for decades. I mean, is this just an inevitable result of this constant mobilization? The whole society becomes kind of militarized and oppressive?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, who was the first person to really point out the problems of militarization in Israeli society? Was it Hannah Arendt? She made some remarks to this effect in the early 1960s, which were not very well received. But yes, I mean, militarization is one problem. The other problem is a lack of clarity about the country's ethnic character, or an attempt to insist that ethnicity is the sole prerequisite for full citizenship. And I think the other problem has been the transition from a socialist to a fully free market economy, without any proper understanding of what the cultural consequences would be for such a transition,
But yeah, this is something we talked about before I pressed the record button, so let's go back to it. There is this tendency in a lot of capitalist societies around the world to shake off the heritage of bourgeois democracy and become more authoritarian. I mean, we see it in Putin's Russia. We see it in the United States a lot. I mean, is Israel also just a case of that?
Yeah, there is a sincere desire to do that, and it's one that's particularly strong on the part of the kind of conservative forces represented by the present Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and the Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman, and the kind of interests they represent, which constitute a constellation of foreign conservative Jewish interests. Like, Sheldon Adelson has been a longtime backer of Bibi, and their views very much correspond, and Adelson is not known to be a fan of liberalism or democracy of any sort of significant kind. And similarly, there is a very long-standing contempt and dislike of democracy in the kinds of circles that the Likud is historically represented in the settlements. Earlier this year, there was a member of the Yesha Council, which is the governing Jewish governing council in the territories, who said that the time of democracy in Israel has essentially expired, and it's time to move on to the next thing. it was such a candid statement, a kind that you would, you know, you knew people believed these sorts of things in the settlements and in the, on the early rights, and never heard people coming out and actually admitting that, you know, because there has been such a strong belief, even in right-wing circles in Israel, that that democracy was, you know, still the most important thing that we had politically in the country. And I think that, Netanyahu has excelled in reconciling these kinds of anti-democratic forces in his current government.
Even democracy just for Jews?
I think they're not even interested in democracy for Jews, no. I don't think that that's something that's on this government's agenda. If you look at the kind of incitement that this government has led in tandem with its parliamentary supporters, for example, against Israel's Supreme Court when it doesn't like the court's positions, it's hard to imagine that there is a dislike for parliamentary democracy in general, that what is preferred is a tyranny of the present parliamentary majority and its government, that they just want to be able to govern and do their thing without any kind of interference from Israel's judiciary. And that's really frightening. And I don't think they're really that interested in the opinion of the armed forces these days either, which is equally interesting. I don't know if you've been following this, but there has been a dramatic conversation that has been underway for the last several months, and a very heated one between the armed forces and the government over going to war in Iran. And the political echelon is absolutely insistent that the military cooperate in preparing to attack the Iranians. And the Israel's military leadership has responded by saying, we're not prepared to attack Iran, and attacking Iran would not necessarily do anyone any good. In fact, it would create a lot more problems than it would solve. Watching this discussion take place between the army and this present government has been fascinating. If you've been taking note of this particular government's dislike of having to answer to legal or parliamentary conventions, what you see in the government's dialogue with the Israeli military establishment is a desire to essentially domesticate the army. That might sound, you know, a little negative, especially to liberals and progressives, but to try to subordinate the army against its own advice against going to war in Iran signifies an attempt to essentially politically master the military so that the military is completely subordinate to the political echelon in a way that would be essentially damaging right now. That's not to say that the military should not always be subordinate, but there is this ironic problem that we're seeing in Israel where the military is advocating a more liberal approach, quote unquote, to the Iranian problem, and that if the military leadership is brought to heel, it would mean the enhancement of this government's political power and a kind of political power that isn't necessarily interested in consensus or democracy.
Well, finally, many years ago, I saw an interview with Marek Kahane, and he was arguing with a liberal Zionist. And Kahane said, look, you have to admit, I'm just being more honest than you are, the implications of Zionism are, you know, it's an ethnic state, and that it can't be as you know, multicultural and as inclusive as you want it to be. I think that was rather perhaps provocatively phrased, but how do you reconcile the nature of Zionism as you know, the founding principle of a country with multi-ethnic, multicultural democracy?
That's the million-dollar question. I mean, certainly you have liberal Israeli intellectuals like Bernard Avishai who say, you know, the solution to this problem is that we have a secular liberal democracy, but a Hebrew civic culture. That buys out the radical nationalists by saying you can speak Hebrew and eat hummus and be Jewish here and have your Israeli Jewish experience, but in a democratic secular context, you know. I mean, there are lots of proposals that have been made to that effect over the years, some less formal than others. Clearly, as critics of Zionism who want to resolve the Zionist impasse properly are often fond of saying, Zionism may be over. Its time may be over. That doesn't mean Israel is over. It means that the ideology creates more problems than it does solutions. And the problems are ones that bedevil both Jewish and Muslim Israelis alike. My personal feelings about all of this are that I would prefer a secular liberal democracy in Israel that fostered tolerance and multiculturalism, and I've never seen such a possibility be so far away. I'm proud of my Israeli heritage. My family's been in Israel since 1882 and has made substantial contributions to the state of Israel, and I would like to imagine that we could create a genuinely democratic multicultural state for everybody in the region.
That was Joel Shalit, co-editor of the webzine Susiant and author most recently of Israel versus Utopia from Akashic Books. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some more Sparks. This one, Angst in My Pants. Till next week, bye.
I hope it doesn't show. It'll go away. It's just a passing phase. It'll go away. You can't just know.